I'm Eunice Scarfe, and we're doing a second day of five on a series called Mother May I, which is stories featuring relationships, not all with mother, but we're using the overriding theme, Mother May I, to suggest the nature of the relationships of characters in stories we're looking at today. Yesterday we read The Little Angel Comes, and I found in my file, and I'm speaking to those of you who were here yesterday, two other stories by the same writer, who has written the same story a second time and a third time from different points of view. And I hinted at that yesterday. It's astonishing what she's done. We've been talking about how a writer works. With the material you've got, how do you approach the actual story form? Who tells the story? And I'm just going to make a brief aside on this and then get on with today's story. But yesterday we heard a narrator tell the story of the death of her sister, her older sister. The narrator was never mentioned. We don't know her name. She's a younger sister. Today, I found in my files the other two times the narrator, the author, tried to work with this material, and she tells it as the cousin. And then we find out the narrator's name was Goethe. And the cousin tells a story of how she arrives at church that night, and she sees Elsa playing the angel, and she hears of the tragic accident. And then there's a third time the author goes at this material, and I have no idea which story comes first, second, or third. But a writer sometimes has a go at a story and says, now I've told it, but I'm going to tell it again, from another person's point of view. It's part of the fun of writing, that whatever material you've got that you want to tell, you can tell it from any character's point of view in the story. Those of you who are interested in Gertrude's stories, other two versions of the death of the child, Elsa, the little angel, might want to borrow that from me. And I also have the text in which the original appears, if some of you had been asking, and I said it'd be available today. We're looking at these stories for the relationships. We're looking at them also because they come under the umbrella of contemporary Canadian writers, largely women writers, though that was not deliberate. We're looking at the stories because we're asking how do writers solve certain problems that they face in terms of setting up something which looks like a story. How do you make a story? And for all of you, at the end of the session, I'm suggesting if you've got material you want to start getting out, and the first stage of a writer's writing is always getting out the stuff, I call it, on paper, and then you start saying, how am I going to shape this? How am I going to begin it? Where am I going to begin? The writer is absolute God and begins any place. You can begin here and flash back. You can begin at the beginning and go right straight through. What's the stuff of your story? Today, the stuff of the story is a child, and I shouldn't say child, a daughter, a grown-up adult daughter, returning to a small town. And for what? She's been called there suddenly, on short notice. What brings you home on short notice from a job to a small town on a day of the week you never expected to be there? A death. A death in the family has brought her home. That's the material in this story. In some ways, it's as tidy a stuff as yesterday. And yesterday was the death of Elsa. And it happened one evening. And so the evening of that death has to be told. Today, it's the daughter returning home for a funeral. The time of the story will be her arrival home and her departure after the funeral. And how many days is that usually in our culture? Three or four days. In Japan, it would be 49 days. We discovered to our astonishment that you would observe the death every seventh day until the 49th day, and then you would be free to let the spirit go and to leave if you were a close relative. 3 or 4 days for our culture. This story's timeline then is 3 or 4 days. But you are going to have material, and I want you to watch for this. How does the writer give you material that has to do with time before the funeral takes place? If we could write stories with color, you would have we could print a story with everything in yellow for flashbacks or memory, and everything in green for what's happening in the present. And it would be very interesting to see the story visually, how much goes back, how much goes forward into what's happening now. But I think you'll be able to follow that yourselves as the narrator flashes back. And of course, the main question we're going to ask is, who are the relationships? What are the relationships in this story? The daughter returns home. We're talking about relationships. Is it the relationship with the person who has died that's going to be the issue here? Is it the relationship with the mother who welcomes her home? And I've raised this question here, and forgive me, minors, this looks like what happens at school, but we'll try to keep it as distant from that as possible. Relationships revealed here, you will have no essays on this, and you won't have to identify characters and no true and false tests. Relationships revealed here what relationships are desired. There is a wanted relationship talked about in this story. There's a lot of relationships going on. There's a relationship in the past that's talked about, someone from the past who's no longer present. And there's a relationship that I think you might call fulfilled relationship, when there's a satisfying relationship going on. Who fits with these different relationships? How many are going on simultaneously? There's a mother that you have to watch out for. You can't miss her, but watch the way, and I put means, watch how the writer gets you to see this mother, and you will, I think, perhaps, if you have any sense of humor at all, which you might not, be slightly amused, at least a little, by the mother that begins to grow and evolve and come forth on these pages. You might recognize this mother, you might have one like this mother, you might wish you had a mother like this, but it will be unmistakable, I think. I think the author does her job. By the end of the story, you know this mother. I have down here show and tell. This writer is incredibly deft, subtle, about showing you the way the mother is, and I call that showing, not telling. She doesn't come right out and say, well, this is what my mother was like. She has the mother talk, and in the process of talking, I think you're going to get what the mother is. In fact, I want to read, if you'll forgive me, and maybe you won't all forgive me, but I'm going to read the writer's words. These are not my words, right? And the writer wrote these words. On page 28, this is a quotation. The mother is looking at a coffee shop with the daughter, and one of the two people, the mother or the daughter, says the following line. To heck with them, she says. I see enough of those old farts at work without having to drink coffee with them, too. That's the character speaking in the story. Is it the mother? Is it the daughter? Any guess? Mm-hmm. Who talks like that? Daughters talk like that, don't they? Is the mother talking? All right, watch for this mother. And that's how the writer characterizes the mother, by what she says, not by coming out and telling you. Okay, and then images of death and dreams show up here. And what's the title significance? Homestead Crescent sounds like a suburb, doesn't it? But
sounds like a roll.
Sounds like what?
A crescent roll.
A crescent roll, all right. The food served at this bakery. And when you finish the end of the story, I think you'll have some notion as to why this story was picked. I want to have a personal note on the writer before we read it, and that's my last comment. This is her first published story. I've known her for some years, and happened by accident, and readers aren't required to know this. In fact, sometimes it's better if they don't know this. Happened to know some of the material which is from her own life, and some which is totally invented. And I said yesterday, and I say it always, that we grant the writer the right to have assumed that everything is invented. It's of some pleasure to me, and I'll say it to you, to know that her father was, in fact, a musical director of a church. So every Sunday she had to watch Dad do the choir directing. And I think you'll see him show up here if you listen carefully. I happen to know that, and this is just between you and me, no writer ever tells this, and no writer's friend ever tells it, unless they're 2,000 miles away, that part, I know, she watched, really, as a child, Dad up there directing. And if he was as much a character as the mother, she may have suffered a little bit, but you'll find this out. All right, it's Homestead Crescent. Feel free to get comfortable. And I will have one or two comments in the course of the story, but mostly the discussion we would like to take up afterwards. My mother's house is at the edge of town, and the view from her kitchen windows is of long, pale fields and scrubby trees and gray, light-filled sky. Late in the day, when I go outside to get dill from the garden, the air smells of smoke, a long snake thread of it drifting over from the town dump, bags of garbage soggy with coffee grounds and orange peel, the edge of an old striped mattress smoldering away on this cool, silent day. I have come home for the funeral of my great-aunt Anna, a relative I hardly knew. I make stew for supper. When my mother gets home from her job at Lakeview Home for the Aged, the house smells of herbs and spices. She walks into this haven of warmth, the bubbling stew and the 6 o'clock news, and sees a daughter setting the table. After supper, we stack the dishes in the dishwasher, go for a brisk walk, the two of us burning off calories on the dirt road outskirts of town. We head in the direction of our old farm, but it is too many miles away, and we turn back somewhere around the cemetery. When we get back to the house, she suggests we play table games, Scrabble, or Sorry, or Memory. We sit at the dining room table where a dim chandelier shines down on our heads, our reflection small and bleak in the black front window where the drapes have been tied back. Around 10, her friend Liz drops in for coffee before going on her night shift at the hospital. The two of them talk and laugh like schoolgirls, and at 5 to 11, Liz hurries out to her ancient Buick with no muffler, and my mother locks all the doors and puts out the lights. And then I feel what I often felt as a child on Sunday evenings at home. That sad, sharp loneliness that came from having spent the day in limbo, torn between the thrill of no school, no having to go anywhere or do anything, and the waiting all day long for something, anything to happen, anything to break the routine of no routine on Sunday. My father, inexplicably pulling on good shoes after his nap on the sofa, or the sound of a car coming up the mile road, anything, held hope in a day as calm and monotonous as a cow swatting flies. All that time on a Sunday floating by, all those hymns from religious radio programs wafting through the house, straight from Pasadena, California, came the grating voice of Dr. Michelson, "Greetings, my dear friends, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ," and when he was done, the sweet, breathy voices of the background choir singing, "He leadeth me." And if this wasn't enough, a mass choir, hundreds of voices, signed off at midnight with "Abide with Me," a tune that pulled you right up to the heavens with its power. And then I would remember, when I listened, that my father had had trouble climbing the steps to his choir director's stand that morning in church, that he had collapsed one day not long ago on the narrow path between the house and the barn, blacked out, my mother said. And I would think of the girl on my school bus who for a whole year was dying of cancer. This night, there are no radio hymns floating through my mother's house. She has her TV on most of the time, watching reruns of Laugh-In and MASH, Three's Company, Barney Miller. Sometimes before she goes to bed, she does exercises. I hear the dull thump, 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 thump of the trampoline, the small, round, rubber bouncer on which she leaps at midnight in the next room. It gets very stormy at night. Wind and rain drive against the house. I wake up because the door is slamming open and shut. The back deck is dry because of the new green plastic roof my mother has put on. The rain bangs tinnily on this roof, and it's hard and unpleasant. Like a flicker of lightning, a short memory of my parents appears. This would be back on the farm, with the two of them running around the yard, closing car windows, garage doors, the day turns suddenly dark and ominous. I see my mother grabbing sheets off the line, yard debris dancing along the ground until it hits the fence. The flash of lightning, the heavy rolling thunder, and then I remember the rain coming down in waves. I remember all of us, Jen and I, our mother, holding pillows to the windows on the west side of the house, the ground white in a matter of minutes from hail. And in all of this, our father is somewhere. Where is he? Outside? Angry, yelling, shaking his fist in despair at the hail. "Don't be such a fool, woman," he's calling out my mother. "Where's your head?" Why was he yelling at her back then? But I'm half asleep now. This must be something I'm dreaming or imagining. At breakfast in the morning. "Do you remember the year we got hailed out?" I asked my mother at breakfast. The air is sharp this morning and smells of wet earth. "Do I remember," she says, reaching for some toast. "That year was a nightmare. Oh, I shouldn't have bread, should I? I've been doing so good on my diet." "Did you have hail insurance?" I persist. "Oh, we never had hail insurance. We couldn't afford it. Who could afford hail insurance those days? It was all we could do to keep you kids fed and clothed. Hand me that knife, will you? I'm allowed as much fruit as I want on this diet. Barb gained 2 pounds last week with cutting down on fruit. I lost 2 eating apples all day. It scientifically worked out, you know, this diet. You are best off following it exactly the way it's written down." She's wiping her hands at the sink, leaning towards the window, trying to see who's driving by. "I remember that time we got hailed out," I say. "How old would I have been?" "You? Oh, I'd have to think. We were married 12 years. You'd have been about grade 4. You're old enough to remember. Darn it! I promised Barb I'd give her a call this morning. What time is it? Do you want to go uptown with me? Go have coffee with Barb and the girls over at the Bright Spot. I start work at 11. The Bright Spot, I said. Yeah, it's that new place over near the IGA. Terrific pastries, not that I can have any. We might as well go. Tomorrow's out. It's a funeral and all. Can't go for the bakery on the funeral day. and they go to the bakery and almost, and they go to the place, and I'm going to skip that little part where they, where she looks in the window and says she doesn't want to see any of them. I make a green salad and boil eggs for supper. My mother tells me a story about old Aunt Anna. How the day after her wedding in a small village in Russia, soldiers come to the bridal couple's new home and wanted Anna to hand over her gold wedding ring. And how Uncle Jacob, small and meek, picked up a brick and told them to get out. And they did. I want my mother to elaborate on this story and others like it. I wanted to embroider the facts, well, just a little. Give me some idea of how things once were, what people were like, how they behaved towards one another. Some images, some clues, anything. But she only told that story to demonstrate Uncle Jacob's tough streak hidden under gentleness. The kids are the same, she says. Those girls, your dad couldn't get them to sing in the choir for anything, as stubborn. They've all got minds of their own in that family. And now she wants to talk about where she works instead, the home. To tell details of tricks they played today or yesterday on guests and on each other too. Who's got a migraine? Whose terrible relatives are waiting for her to die so they can back up to her door with their truck and take the antiques out of her room. This is a senior citizen's home. Geez, I could have killed myself laughing at Barb today, my mother says, crunching into some celery. Laugh, thought I'd die. Like a child, I drag her back. Mother, remember that story about someone having to hide their son on the boat when they came to Canada? Because he had lice or something? Oh, that was your father, she says. What happened? I know it was my father. What happened? Well, nothing happened. He had lice. They wrapped his head in a kerchief, hoping nobody would notice, and it worked. Do you want some more salad? Well, wasn't there something about him almost having to stay behind? Oh, that, she says, yeah. You mean when they were in England, waiting to get on the boat? If they would have found out about the lice, he would have had to stay behind. Yeah, I say. And the parents, they would have left without him? Well, what choice did they have, she said, sure. I say, they wouldn't have gone without him, mother. Would they? She doesn't answer. Why talk about that, I can feel her thinking. Soon she's in the middle of an account of Mrs. Parker's recent attempt to switch places at the dining room table at the seniors' home with Mrs. Baker, just so Ida Parker wouldn't have to sit next to piggish old Bert Lowe anymore. Crumbs, was I mad, she said. They'll do anything to get their way. You wouldn't believe how they behave. Well, Bert Lowe walks up to this table at supper. I was so pissed off. Excuse my language, she says to me. My mother says to me, excuse my language. He knocks over a glass and crashes into a chair. This mother whom we pity, this silent, mistreated farm wife, fat, meek, self-conscious in her dark, flowered print dress, trundling. What kind of person trundles? Skinny girl. You see her? She's large. Trundling up to the choir loft every Sunday because he told her to. Singing alto in a second row center. We saw her face up there. How she avoided looking anywhere. Especially at him making a spectacle of himself. He was dancing on the choir director's stand. Bug-eyed, whispering loudly, come on, show some gumption, all of you. What are you, a bunch of nine-year-olds? And on the way home in the car, he'd say to her, what's wrong now? Wasn't I respectable enough for you at church? But she wouldn't answer. And in the barn at night, he'd be shouting at the cows, move, move. Stop it, she'd say finally, spitting her words, almost whispering in the car. Don't you care what your own children think? And he'd laugh. He'd laugh at her. And after supper of that same day, he'd say, well, I guess we better go to evening service. And she'd stare at him as if he were crazy. And then she'd hurry to get ready, slapping us around, trying to get us into decent clothes again to go back to church. Sometimes he changed his mind about church when he saw us all ready. Her hair neatly combed, nylons, high-heeled shoes. And he'd say, we're not going. Why talk about the past, my mother would say. We eat in the family room. My mother carries her supper in on a tray so she won't miss mash. At 11:15 in the evening, I drive to the airport to get Jenny. We haven't seen each other for 6 months. Her coming home is my idea, something we arranged by phone. The funeral's only an excuse. She's not sitting around the house feeling sorry for herself, I ask. Not quite, Jen. She's having the time of her life. The first evening, the hours stretch into morning, and we sit and talk before we go to bed until the sight of a pale streaked sky of this early hour reminds me that it's morning. After he died, I came home and expected him in one of the usual places, in that chair in one corner of the living room near the green fern. Always surprised he wasn't in the room with all the other people who were there, who had come to offer their condolences, silent, embarrassed people doing their best. I would hear him talking in the room. I knew he was still there. I went into all the rooms in the house and put on the lights so that no dark places existed. And that first night I was afraid to go downstairs to the room where the piano was kept. In the morning, Jen and I drive our mother to work. She's wearing a white uniform of which she is proud, white shoes, white stockings. Did you see her underwear? Jen says she's wearing bikinis now. You could see the flowers right through the uniform. Remember the kind she used to wear when we were little? She used to wear those long bloomer tights. We drive in the country down old roads. There are shiny new silos now, a new bungalow. Remember when we came out here last summer? But Jen doesn't remember, and it's only me who remembers our visit to the cemetery where our dad is buried. On the last time I visited home, Dad wanted to know if I needed money. No, I said, pretending surprise. Why would I need money? I've got a good job, remember, Dad? I was telling you last night. And he cleared his throat and said, well, we've sold the farm now. He wanted to tell me about how they finally had enough to live on, and now they could afford to help us kids. Why save it all up for the future, I said to him. He said to me. He waited for me to say something, but I couldn't do it. I don't need any help, I insisted in a light voice. I was stacking the dishes or putting them away in a cupboard, doing anything to avoid an encounter with him, to find him telling me that he didn't expect to live much longer. After supper that night, Jen and I go over to the church to practice the song we've been asked to sing by the family for the funeral. It's wonderfully lit up inside, a warm orange glow from the sunset. We wander around like children. We sneak behind the pulpit and look down where the congregation will be and imagine who will be sitting there. We sit in the choir loft and end up talking until it's nearly dark. Neither of us can remember much about Aunt Anna. She was my father's cousin. We don't know her children. None of them stayed around here. We've come home to see each other. If you drove by the cemetery now at night, you would see the red glow somewhere near the back in the new part of the cemetery. The red coals, used for pulling frost from the ground, glowing softly in the dark. Aunt Anna had pitch black hair until she turned 65. She leaves 4 daughters and her husband, sad old Uncle Jacob. There's a note stuck on the fridge when we get back. Be back around 10, went over to Liz's for coffee. At midnight, we realize Mother's not home yet. We start worrying when we remember that Liz goes to work at 11. Liz, what's her name? Mezier? Tezier? I say, try that. And we phone. Oh, she's there all right. I can hear the party going on in the background. It's the night before the funeral, and my mother is partying with Liz. They're playing Kenny Rogers on the record player. 4 hungry children and a crop in the field. I remember. You picked a fine time to party, Mother, I think. I'm leaving this minute, she says, like a contrite child. I didn't realize it was so late. Liz isn't working tonight. I'll be home right away. When she gets home, her eyes are merry. She said something to drink. She flings herself on the couch, smiling, sits up defensively when she realizes both of us are watching her, disapproving. That Liz is a scream, she says. We're doing a play for talent night at the seniors' home, and she's the main character. Laugh, but I die. And she launches into an explanation of the play. Jen pages slowly through a photograph album. Who's this, Mom? This guy with the mustache. Mother leans over, squinting. Oh, him, she says, without any interest. That's one of that Peters family. We're related. I can never tell them apart. Or was he a friend of your father's? Do either of you want anything to eat? I can still have a fruit tonight, according to my diet. She comes back from the kitchen with her orange, wraps an afghan around her shoulders, and settles back to watch Merv Griffin. The sky is gray on the day of Great Aunt Anna's funeral. Jen and I drive over to the church around noon to go through our song one more time. Jen's voice cracks accidentally on a high note, and instantly we lapse into our long-ago imitation of familiar voices. Standing at the pulpit, we pretend first we're the aunt, notorious for the croaky, swooping soprano, and then I pretend I'm our mother with that rich, slightly forced contralto. We hold the last note as long as possible, and Jen races down to end the chord with a flourish of music at the piano. We've barely settled down when a door slams and two of the Peters girls walk in carrying flowers, Rebecca and Mary. They are cheerful, healthy, rosy-cheeked, gray-haired. They lead the conversation, as they should. It's their mother's funeral, and we talk about the weather and what Jenny and I are up to these days. They put the flowers on the piano, but they say nothing about their mother, and we go home. In the house, my mother is lying down. She's in her bedroom and has the drapes pulled. She's lying flat on her back in her black dress and Sunday shoes. We approach her cautiously on either side of the bed. She sits up quickly. Is it time? At the funeral, people's clothes smell damp. Everyone is very sober, but checking to see who's here, who they recognize, and try not to look as if they're looking. Bev Dick is playing Bach on the piano. It's very unusual. Around here, it's usually safe in the arms of Jesus or in the sweet by and by, never Bach. Despite the grayness of the day, the church is filled with a cool, bright light, like looking at a seashell. So why do I hear in my mind my mother's alto voice? There it is. I can hear her in the second row of the ladies' choir up in the choir loft. In my memory, I can hear her humming her rich choir alto, not quite on key. The way she hums along in restaurants when she's waiting for her meal to arrive, or in a grocery store lineup, humming along, unaware of what she's doing. Jen and I look at each other, a dangerous thing to do in this atmosphere. My sister is looking at me, and I realize we're supposed to sing. Stand in front of the congregation right now, just when we're almost giggling, and present them with our calm, familiar version of a hymn. It's easy to do, accompanied by the pouring rain outside, with the hum of the rain on the roof. And something else. She wouldn't. I can't turn around to look. Is my mother singing along with us? Or is it a trick? I'm sure I hear her humming. But maybe I'm finally sounding like her when I sing. And that's a nightmare. And then in my mind, I see the whole congregation singing now, standing. And this is memory again. My father pleading with them, sing, sing, sing now, with sweat on his forehead from waving his arms. At the reluctant farmers, the prim wives, the ashamed daughters, that's me and Jen, all of them singing along, again, the second verse again. My mother says there were times when he didn't want to leave the congregation singing anymore. I never knew that. His dizzy spells. He was afraid he would lose his balance, topple to the floor. A heap in front of everyone. I didn't know that. I thought he never was worried about being embarrassed. Well, why did he make such a spectacle of himself every Sunday? I asked her that this morning, but as usual, she kept that indifferent expression on her face, that look that said she would not be drawn into further conversation about him or the past. Then the phone rang, and it was Liz talking about the talent show. The look on her face was that of a teenager's confronted by parents who wanted answers. Jen and I finish. We shuffle slowly out of the church, past the open coffin. One last look at old Aunt Anna made up with powder and lipstick to look the way she never looked in real life. This was the moment, the building in which 5 years earlier, my mother cried out like an animal in pain. For 3 days after my father died, she had been calm, doing everything she had to do, phoning across the country to her children, making arrangements and dealing with people. But now, at this moment, she had called out to him as if he heard her. She tried to make him hear her, to make him understand how she needed him and her love. But pale men in black, who were used to these outbursts, took her firmly by the shoulders and led her away. Outside the church, it is still raining, but the air smells fresh and clean. People are relieved to be out of the church, umbrellas opening. Well, hello, hello, haven't seen you for years. It's all over now, only the family left. My mother gives me the car keys, slumps down in the back seat. There's no point in us going to the cemetery, she says. And we work our way along in the procession until we see Homestead Crescent. After supper, we play hearts. My mother is competitive when she plays. She wants to win. She gives all her attention to the game and doesn't like it if Jen or I are slow about taking a turn. She does win most of the games. Around 10, Liz phones and says she can't make it tonight. She has company. It's probably Melvin coming to visit her, says my mother knowingly. I'll bet you anything it's Melvin. He's been starting to drop in on her. I'll find out tomorrow. It's our last night, so Jen and I stay up till 4 in the morning. Our mother shuffles out of her bedroom when she hears us in the hallway. A wild-looking, middle-aged figure, half asleep, bewildered. Is it time? She says, echoing the words she used just before we went to the funeral. What do you mean, Mother? Says Jen. I thought I heard something. Did he say it was all right? Who? Says Jen patiently. Well, your father. I thought if I didn't say anything, he'd let you go. Her hair stands straight out from her head on one side. On the other side, it's pressed flat. I must have been dreaming, she says finally. What a dream. You were in it, both of you. What was it? I ask reluctantly. Oh, it's not worth repeating, she says, puzzled. On top of everything else, you two were taking me shopping. You wanted me to buy an old-fashioned house dress for some reason. Crazy.